Lots of us these days want to eat food that's locally grown because we feel it's good for the environment or it's more ethically produced. Chef Matthew Evans says having that local connection to food is also good for the soul. He's a farmer now and the gourmet farmer on SBS, so he's really taken that on board. And his wonderful book, The Real Food Companion, has just been updated because a lot has changed in the decade or so since he first wrote it. Matthew Evans, hello. Nice to speak with you again.
Thanks for having me, Hilary.
It's a pleasure. As you write in your prologue, climate change, the pandemic, floods, fires, cropland loss, all these things have accelerated since the first edition of this book. How much can reconnecting with our food systems help with that and with our anxieties around that?
Yeah, look, I think it can help enormously. The thing is that we all actually have this power in our hands every time we choose what we're going to put on the table to eat. And it's not like we have a choice about eating. We have to eat. You know, we have choices of, you know, whether you play tennis or whether you go sailing and other things in life. But food is something we all do. We all are empowered every time we make a decision about what to put on the table. Not only, you know, is it good for us? Is it good for, you know, is it delicious? Is it good for our community? But also, is it good for the planet?
Well, yeah, that's a big thing for a lot of people, though. I mean, so many other things come into play, don't they? Price, availability, affordability, taste. And I know that that's a big theme for you in the book. Tell us what you mean when you talk about real food.
Yeah, so it's a real food is a relatively simple concept, but I think, you know, we there's a lot of vested interests or a lot of things that get in the way of real food. Real food doesn't have to be posh, it doesn't have to be fancy. In fact, it probably shouldn't be. It shouldn't be expensive necessarily. It's about, I guess, knowing and trusting what you eat. So it seems very simple. It's what everyone, you know, up till about 100 years ago, we all kind of knew where food came from. We either grew it or we knew the grower, and we could trust how it was produced, and we could trust how it was, you know, the processing that went on after it was grown. And I guess what we've done in the last, you know, certainly in the last 50 years is we've removed ourselves from the land, but also removed ourselves from the source of the produce. And a lot of people don't trust what they eat. They don't know what they're eating. And I think a lot of things are done in our name that are perhaps questioned in terms of environmental or animal welfare concerns, and yet we all hold this ability to make better choices, you know. And like you said, not everyone has the money, not everyone has the geography, but some of us do have that luxury of choice and the ability to make a better decision for us, for our family.
It's a bit sad, isn't it, that it's a luxury for some? I mean, what would you like to see change about our food systems, Matthew Evans, when it comes to, you know, the fact that most of us buy most of our stuff in supermarkets? Is there a way we could change that?
Yeah, look, there are ways to change it. It's Urban Agriculture Month. So, you know, if you added up all the cities in the world and all the land we've built on, it would be about the seventh biggest country in the world. And so that's a lot of land, but it's not lost to growing food if we take it into our own dirty hands to plant some herbs, you know, on our balcony, or to maybe sow a few carrots in our garden or whatever it is, to actually grow a little bit. And I'm a big fan of the urban garden. A billion people, one in eight people feed themselves from urban gardens around the world. So it's not, we often think of farming or growing food, it has to be big scale. And yes, if you want to grow wheat, you know, you probably need a a big area and a tractor. Having grown it by hand, I think, you know, it is hard. But lots of things, you know, growing a few beetroots, growing a few potatoes, you know, growing some lettuce, you know, that you can just pick each every day when you want a few leaves. That is something we can actually take control of. And I think a lot of us, you know, during COVID in particular, suddenly went, you know what, I've got the time and the opportunity to think about this a bit more and go, hang on, where's it coming from? Why has that supply system shut down? Oh, I'm buying cherries from America, or I'm buying, you know, lemons from Mexico, or whatever it is. And then you go, oh, okay, so maybe if I think about this a bit more carefully, I can buy seasonal, it's going to taste better, it's going to be, you know, leave the money in my community and be better for the world as a whole.
Yeah, we've really got used to having everything on sale all the time, haven't we, regardless of seasonality. Would you like to see some change to that? I guess whether that's better education of consumers or some kind of signage in shops that says this is not meant to be on sale right now.
Yeah, and it's really hard to get, you know, close to the seasons unless you do grow. Like, we grow everything we eat pretty much. And even for me, sometimes I go, oh, what happened to the, you know, why is there no carrots? It's like, oh, because we can't germinate carrot seeds in winter. So there's a gap in the carrot season. And so I think that sort of understanding, look, there's brilliant work being done in Tassie through the 24 Carrot Garden Scheme and nationally through the Stephanie Alexander Kitchen Garden Scheme in schools. to say to kids, this is what grows. Look at it grow. This is how you cook it. I think we have lost some of the skills for how to cook good food simply from what is seasonally available. So it's multifaceted. You know, it does break my heart that one in five Tasmanians, and I think it's like one in 10 Australians, is food insecure. So it means that once a week, they don't even know where one of their meals is coming from. And that's an appalling statistic in a rich society. So how do we fix that? Well, there's food deserts. So, you know, we rely on supermarkets. Not everyone has a car and everyone can get to those supermarkets. More food grown closer to where it's consumed will fix that problem. But it'll also fix, you know, some of our nutrient deficits. It also gives people meaning and purpose and is a rewarding thing to be involved in. So there are lots of ways we can do this, whether it's community gardens, it's, you know, house gardens, it's guerrilla gardening on your verge. But you know, I also think we shouldn't get worried when we can't make good choices, or, you know, you just want to get dinner on the table. The single most important thing is that you enjoy a meal and ideally enjoy it in company.
Yeah, it's a really interesting mix in your book, Matthew Evans, about the practical and, I don't know if it's the spiritual, but the kind of the other benefits, the soul food benefits of connecting to our food. Just a quick question before we talk about some of the detail, because there's some fascinating conversations, I think, to be had around the ethics of food. But is your concern just, you know, where and how the food is grown? Or is it also that you'd like to see people know more about the story behind what they're eating?
Yeah, like, I think the story is the way we connect, you know, that's a really big one. So, yeah, I think it's really interesting that I think we should eat more variety of foods. I think we should, eat more seasonally. I think these are sort of no-brainers in terms of when the people who are involved in the food production system, these are really good things for everyone concerned. But also, one of the ways we can connect to our food is through the story. So we see it with wine. Wine's the great example. You know, people can say, oh, you know, I met the winemaker and I know where where her children go to school and, you know, which side of the hill it was all grown on and how they picked it. But no one can tell you that about the asparagus or the Japanese turnips or the kohlrabi or the broccoli. So food has been commoditized and in the sense we've kind of lost the fact that it is nurtured from the earth by a living soul, by a person, and the better food is actually connected to that person. It's, you know, the flavor of the food, the quality is actually a reflection of the soul of the grower, and the soul of the grower is actually reflected in how they treat soil, topsoil, this magic bit of the earth that does all of the world's growing. You know, there are people who are growing topsoil while growing food, but there's also people who are damaging topsoil while growing food. And so our little choices about, you know, what are we going to have for lunch today, that actually can have a big cumulatively can have a big impact.
Well, those choices. You know what you're talking about when it comes to soil, because you've written a whole book on it and there's a lot in that. We spoke about that on Life Matters. People can find that interview on our website. But Matthew, when we think about both affordability and farming practices, do you think we should all be eating organic food? Is that an important thing, or just other kinds of quality farming?
Yeah, look, organic's a really interesting one. Yeah, look, I think it's really valuable, organics, because they're using less poisons, essentially, less herbicides, less insecticides, pesticides, they're not using any artificial ones. And so it's beneficial in that way. I think knowing and trusting what you eat is more important, but what organics does is it's a third-party certification. So if you go to the supermarket, so, you know, if you go to a butcher and your local butcher and they can show you, you know, pictures of the farm where the meat has come from, or you go to your farmer's market and meet the person who's growing your potatoes, that's very different than the supermarket. The supermarket, you're kind of relying that someone else has done a good job on your behalf. And third-party certification, organic certification, means someone has gone to that farm and said, yeah, we've checked that they don't use poisons, we've checked that they're looking after soil health, we've checked they're looking after animal welfare, and you can trust this more than the thing that doesn't have that certification. So I think it's super valuable, but it's not the be-all and end-all.
Yeah, I mean, if we look beyond organic, Matthew Evans, what kind of farms are best in your opinion? Can you have, for example, a large operation that's also doing regenerative farming or being kind to the environment or otherwise sustainable?
Yeah, it gets trickier with scale, and there are people who think it's not possible, but I actually think it is possible at scale, but it does take humans involved. You know, people can damage land and people can improve land. There's the Haggertys in Western Australia are an example, or the Goods family in Western Australia, who grow grains, which are typically, you know, not necessarily the best thing for the environment. They grow it in a way that is making more nutrient-dense food while building topsoil by just rethinking, you know, the way you do it. So, yes, it can be done at scale, but a lot of what we have done at scale over the last 50 years has not considered the ramifications, the actual true cost of food production. And so we might need to revisit that. And it doesn't mean food has to become astronomically more expensive, but it might mean that we need to grow food in areas that are more suitable or use less artificial fertilizer because that's damaging our waterways and the air that we breathe, all those kind of things. How can we do it better? And what I'm a big fan of is, like everything to do with food, this book is called The Companion. It's supposed to be something nice that you can carry through life that is just there as a gentle voice saying, what can we do better? Don't beat yourself up for the bad decisions or the poor decisions or the decisions you don't have a choice over. But what can we do better? Because humanity, I think, is all about making incremental steps to be better at what we do. And for a while with food, what we've done is gone, I just want it cheaper and I want it quicker. But is it better? And is it better for us? And I think to some extent it hasn't been better for us, and it hasn't been better for the environment that nurtures us.
Well, I love this about the book in that it has these different sections for dairy, for meat, for game, for fish and seafood, and you delve down into the ethical questions around those things too. It was a fascinating read. And I love that you described this revelation you had about milk, Matthew Evans, that you'd got to drink this milk, this unhomogenized full cream milk that had been caressed into being. It's a beautiful phrase. But, I mean, you also raised some of the ethical issues around milk. Is there a way to drink that beautiful dairy milk without being a horrible calf killer?
To produce milk, you need to bring calves into the world. So, a cow is a mammal, and just like humans, you don't produce milk until there's a baby been born. So you do bring calves into the world. So if you eat dairy, if you drink milk, then you have to realize there is a calf born, and so you probably should eat veal. That's the reality of that production system. There are animals dying all the time for all sorts of things. So we in our market garden, we kill more animals to grow vegetables than we do to produce all the dairy and beef and goat and pig or pork on the farm.
Oh, do you mean insects?
Yeah, sometimes insects, sometimes wallabies and possums, sometimes they get into, because whenever you produce delicious, nutritious food, something else wants to eat it. So I've met people who shoot the cockatoos who eat the pistachios, or the ducks that eat the rice, or it's a very fraught area, and we're very frightened of the idea of death.
But yes, so there are rules around that in various parts of Australia, and it's probably worth looking up what you're allowed to shoot too.
Oh yeah, no, they all have crop protection permits. Like you can get a what's called a crop protection permit, and so when you read that someone's killed wombats because they're getting on golf courses, I think that's a terrible thing to be doing, but that's what happens because people have what humans want to do things, and animals are sometimes a problem for us. But no matter what you grow, there is an impact on the environment, and so good farmers say, well, how do we grow food? How do we do it? And can we do it forever? Because actually plants, animals, and soil have coexisted for 400 million years or more, but humans growing food, we just need plants and animals. That's all we need to grow food. But we haven't done a very good job over the last, 200 years in particular, in doing that without damaging the environment. So how can we do it forever? Because actually pretty much the only thing we can do forever is grow food. We can't dig up stuff forever. We can't, mine forever. We can't burn fossil fuels forever. We know that. But growing food, we can. So how do we do it? How do we do it better? If there's an impact on an animal, how can we make that impact, as kind as possible? And some people choose not to eat animals, and that's fine. But there are animals impacted no matter what food you grow is, I guess, what am I thinking with that?
Yeah, well, I found it interesting that you talk about veal in the book. I want to pick up on the mention of veal before. You're saying if you want to help with the fact that calves are integral to the dairy industry and you want to drink milk, then you would eat veal. A lot of people are going to recoil and say, what, isn't veal horrifically cruel? Just clarify how it happens in Australia these days.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things that dairy farmers now can buy sexed semen, so they can actually choose to have less male calves born. But if you're running a dairy and you're having calves born, you might keep all the young female calves for your to replace the dairy cows. But the boy calves sometimes are killed, like 4 or 5 days old or a week old if they aren't reared for meat. So veal in Australia is not, in Europe, it's, you know, they have this system where they keep them anemic. So they keep them low in iron. They keep them out of the sun. You know, it's very white veal. Here we have what's called rose veal. So it's a calf that stays on it, you know, on milk for a while and then eats grass. It's a youngish animal, but so are, you know, every animal you eat is generally young, chickens in particular, but ducks, pigs, pretty much everything is sexually immature. So veal is no lamb, you know, there's no difference in that sense that it's a young animal. But, you know, if you're going to use dairy, then having an animal that's 9 months old that's been able to, you know, eat green grass, you know, walk around in the sunshine, socialise, is a better use of that life, in my view, than killing it at 3 days old because people are frightened to eat veal. You know, where's the better system? You know, I don't think there's any ideal system, but yeah, where's the better thing for me? Value the life, honour the life, use all of the animal that you've created in this process to create dairy.
And that's, I mean, that helps with the affordability issue, doesn't it, too? If you're not just going for the fillet steak from each individual beast, you're using more of the animal.
Yeah, using more of the animal. And, you know, when I forget the numbers on how many pigs and, you know, kangaroos are killed in Australia every year. And it's kind of weird that we're sort of rearing animals to kill to eat. So, you know, beef or lamb or goat, I guess. And then killing a whole bunch of native animals or feral animals and not eating that and just wasting that. So I often see this camels. I think we kill, you know, tens of thousands of camels every year in Australia. And they're just left to rot. And then we go and rear a cow to eat. And I'm like, well, is that the best use of the world's resources? Is it honouring the lives of the animals that have lived? You know, I often think, well, what can we do better? And look, I don't have the answers. But what I want to pose, I guess, is the question is, when you have the capacity to make better choices, you know, when you've got the time, the money, the geography, you know, you're in the right place where stuff is available, can you make a better choice and be the person that you are in your head? Because I think often, like me in my head, I'm a really great person until I get to the checkout and then I realise, oh, that's cheaper. You know, oh, those cage eggs are a bit cheaper than the free range. And I think we're all better in our heads than we are in reality. But the more we can become the person in reality that we are in our heads, then that is what's actually going to make, you know, better farming systems, better food systems, better nourishment, better communities and a better world.
Yeah, it's really interesting. This topic has sparked a text, Matthew, that says, please stop this. It is upsetting, this discussion of, you know, how we raise animals and use animals. And then this text from Nick too, hunting has given me the deepest connection to my food that I've experienced for many years. Also has brought a close and embodied connection to a knowledge of the environment I hunt in. It's comparable perhaps to eating veggies that you grow yourself, says Nick. And I guess it sounds like what you're talking about, Matthew, is, as you said, honouring the animal, but also just having a really deep think about the systems that we have around food and the economics that we have around food as well.
Yeah. Look, and I know this might sound really, you know, scary to people who aren't involved in farming systems, but, you know, when you meet the apple grower who shoots the possums, who shoots hundreds of possums to protect their crop, you know, you have to, the understanding of how food is grown and that something, when you grow something, you know, delicious, whether it's, you know, almonds in the Riverine. I met a guy who flies helicopters to frighten the birds off the almonds. You can't tell me that's good for the environment, you know, flying a helicopter to frighten birds. And they probably shoot some as well. You know, there are things done all the time to grow our food that people who don't grow food maybe don't understand. And I guess what I would like to be is that, or help, is be that a conduit between, you know, like food is, we're just trying, farmers are, you know, people just trying to grow food. If you've grown food in your backyard, you'll know something wants to eat it. And so how do we grow food for the community, grow it, you know, locally, seasonally, nutrient dense, and do it in a way that has, you know, the best impact? You know, it's going to have, farming always has an impact, or growing food always has an impact. Humans always have an impact.
Yeah.
But how do we do it that impact can be repaired by nature? Because nature is constantly repairing the damage that humans do. How do we do it in a way that nature can repair what we do?
And just quickly, Matthew, I've loved the way in your book you do talk about, you know, the hierarchy of choices and that everyone has various constraints on their lives. If you don't live near a farmer's market, or you've got a job and kids and no time to trek around to anywhere but the supermarket, what are some of your tips for making the better choices at the checkout?
Yeah, look, the better choices, I guess, are really understanding seasons. So, you know, if you, just about all of the markets and state governments and and even the supermarkets will have seasonal guides. So what actually is in season? You can usually tell. It's the thing that's most abundant and cheapest on the shelf is in season. You know, if your neighbour has chickens and they like to have holidays, you know, maybe you could look after their chickens and get some eggs in return, or you've got rhubarb and they've got lemons, you know, try and take control of that sort of side if you do have the capacity to grow anything, or the ability to help someone who grows something, and making those decisions when you're at the supermarket. Look, does it say RSPCA approved? Well, that's a well-trusted organisation. That's probably going to be something better than not, than something that's not RSPCA approved. Is it organic? That's probably a pretty good certification. Have I got the money? No, not today. Well, maybe next time. You know, just all those little cumulative decisions, you know, can make do really make a difference to our food systems, but they also put better dinner on your plate. Yes, the thing when you find fresh, seasonal, local produce, it actually tastes so much better. You don't have to be as good a cook, you don't have to spend as much time in the kitchen, and yet you still get as much joy and pleasure from what you put on the table.
And joy and pleasure are the bulk of this book, this updated edition of The Real Food Companion. Matthew Evans, lovely to chat with you today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Hilary. See ya.
See ya. Matthew's a chef and food critic turned farmer.
It's easier than ever to hear your favourite local and national ABC radio stations, live and on demand on the ABC Listen app.